At this time, we're going to introduce the speaker. I'm going to introduce the speaker who's going to introduce the speaker, if you can follow that. And that would be Terry S. So come on. Yeah.
Thank you, Sean. What a kind introduction. Yeah, I have the honor of introducing a friend of mine. She called last month, and she called me, and she said, "My name's Terry, and I'm an alcoholic, by the way." She said, "I need to speak. I need to tell my story." And I said, "Wait, I've never heard that before. Somebody's volunteering to tell their story." But I made a couple calls, and of course, Sean was the first. She wanted to speak in front of a big crowd. I think you guys did a good job tonight. Thanks. But she, we made some calls and got her here, and she's real excited because this is a special day for her. It kind of fell on it. But I've known Kim for quite some time, and I've watched Kim, and she's watched me. We've both kind of just been going through recovery together, if you will. But what I've learned from Kim is no matter what, stay consistent. Always stay in the middle of the pack. And no matter what, she doesn't pick up a drink or drug, no matter what. And she'll tell you all about it. She's got some challenges, and she's got some beautiful things in her life. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce my friend Kim Y.
And he lies, I didn't say a big group. Whew. I'm Kim, and I'm an alcoholic. And I have cotton growing in my mouth right now because I'm nervous, but hopefully it'll go away. And before I get started, I really want to thank Sean for allowing me to tell my story tonight. And I want to thank Terry for making it happen. He's my soul brother in recovery, and I love him. And I have my tissues because I'm a crier. I want to thank my sponsor for being here because she is the light in my tunnel, and I love her very much. And the ladies that I sponsor for keeping me engaged in recovery and keeping me doing the deal, because I wouldn't be here tonight if I wasn't doing the deal. And I can't keep it unless I give it away, and I can't give it away if I don't got it. So, and to my friends that gave up their Friday night to come here and support me, because today is a really special day for me. It was 26 years ago today that I went into a treatment facility. My sobriety birthday is August 7th, 1989. And I need to clap for y'all because y'all are what got me here and have helped me along the way. Can I move this down without causing a problem? So I don't have to stand on my tippy toes. When I was in the treatment center, we had an alumni picnic while I was there, and there was a lady that told her story, and that was the first situation that I'd heard of somebody speaking about actually being sober out in the real world. Because when you're in treatment, you're learning the tools. And she talked about living in the real world, and it really helped me turn a corner and made me realize that, you know, that's what we do. And so I had told Terry that I really wanted to speak at a treatment center. And the one that I went to is now a nursing home. So that wasn't an option for me. And I knew he was involved with Ridgeview. And so when he told me the day that I got to come speak, I freaked out. Because I'm like, are you kidding? That's my actual birthday. So anyway. Okay, so what it used to be like, what happened and what it's like now. I grew up in a pretty emotionally unstable home. My mother, you know, did the best she could, but she had a lot of issues. And I was alone a lot. And a child left alone a lot will be very creative to keep themselves entertained. And I had very little supervision. My mom was in and out of mental institutions from suicide attempts, and I was very afraid a lot because I never knew what I was going to come home to with her. And I think we did a role change very early on where I became the mama and she was the sick child. She was in a very abusive marriage. My parents got divorced when I was three, but my stepfather was not a very nice person, and he, you know, smacked her around a lot in front of me, and again, a lot of fear. And I, you know, because I was an only child, I was alone an awful lot, and like I said, learned to entertain myself. And I can remember laying on the couch one day and watching some old Elizabeth Taylor movie, and she's sitting, I think she was portraying drunk. She might have been really drunk, I don't know. And she had her glass of wine, and she was crying and acting all dramatic and her big long cigarette. And I can remember thinking, she's so beautiful, and she, look what she's doing. She's so cool, and I want to be just like her one day. My, I didn't end up quite so glamorous, but I did follow that path. When I look back on my childhood, before I ever even took a drink, I realized that saying in the rooms, you know, we're egomaniacs with an inferiority complex. I got that. I was so desperate for attention and to be a part of something. I would do crazy things, like I remember spending a day out in my backyard jumping from a tree trying to break my leg so I could have a cast. Never broke it. Still have never broke a bone. I did the cutting thing, but I didn't hide my cutting because I wanted people to see what was going on so that, again, that I could get that attention that I so craved. I can remember also one day before school putting toothpaste in my eyes, and they were beet red and, you know, very irritated. And I went to school and, you know, everybody gave me attention because of that. I mean, just pretty much willing to go to any length, you know, to have someone notice me. And always very desperate to be in the popular crowd. And honestly, I usually was. But when I got what I was looking for, the boy that I liked me back or whatever, then I thought, well, something must be wrong with them, because why would they like me? And so nothing ever satisfied me. Nothing was ever good enough. I believe that I started drinking around 10 years old, and I don't remember my first drink. What I do remember is in that couple of years from about 10 to 12 is the sense of ease and comfort that I got when I took that drink. And of course, when I discovered that I could drink enough to actually go in a blackout, that was freaking heaven. That was so much fun to me. And drinking also gave me a lot of purpose, because I looked forward to the weekends when we could steal some parents' booze or whatever and, you know, get high, get drunk. And that's really all I can remember about growing up, was my desire was to be drinking. My desire wasn't to go to college or, you know, do anything fulfilling in life. It was to just be out of my mind drunk. Because when I drank, it's like Chuck Chamberlain talks about in A New Pair of Glasses. He says that we are seeking to be a part of something. And he believes, and I believe for me, that I was kind of born here feeling not a part of anything. And alcohol helped bring me into feeling like I belonged, like I was a part of something. And the best way to describe it is that feeling. And I wanted it all the time. I started having blackouts by the age of 13. I started getting in physical altercations with my mother, and she became afraid of me for good reason. And she sent me here to Georgia to live with my dad when I was 14 years old. And he was in the Air Force, and my stepmother had grown up in an alcoholic home. And she noticed right away, she's like, Kim has an alcohol problem. And my dad didn't really buy into that, but they started sending me to a therapist very shortly after I got to Georgia. And of course, the therapist told me that based on my childhood, that I had a reason to be crazy and ill-behaved. And so, you know, it gave me an excuse for my behavior. I was a daily drinker by 16 years old. I got my DUI when I was 16 years old. And I left for a football game. And the last thing my dad said to me, because I was driving his car, is don't drink and drive. And we never got to the football game. We went, you know, and got drunk, and I got arrested, and my friend took a taxi back to my house and knocked on the door and said, I lost Kim at the football game. And then they got the phone call, collect call from Kim in the Cobb County Detention Center or whatever it was. So that was my DUI round. I only went to jail once, and I learned a little bit from that. At 17, I quit school and got my GED. But again, I didn't really have any goals or dreams. I just wanted to party. And because I wasn't doing well in school anyway, my parents let me do that. And it was shortly after that that I ended up in a mental institution because I was on Xanax through the therapist. And I got angry at my boyfriend one night and took the whole bottle of Xanax and tried to jump through a plate glass window and ended up in the loony bin. And so what I learned from those two experiences, the jail and the mental institution, was just really how to behave, because I didn't want to end up locked up anymore. It didn't teach me maybe you have a drinking problem. It was you need to behave so that you don't end up in those situations. And so I did behave. I moved out of my house at 18 years old. And the reason that I moved out was a friend of mine that I went to high school with happened to come over one weekend, and she was a waitress down at a strip club in Atlanta. And she said, you can make really good money waiting tables. And so I said, cool, and you can drink on the job. So it was awesome. And I went down and started waiting tables at Ponytails. And it wasn't long before I realized that the girls that were dancing there were making a whole lot more money, and they didn't have to work very hard for it. So you know that where that story went. So I ended up stripping down at Ponytails Lounge, and one night I met a guy there, and we were leaving, going out the front door, and the bouncer said, Rachel, that was my stage name, you don't want to leave with him, he's trouble. And, you know, it was my business, no one else's business, and I didn't care, and I was very physically addicted at this point and really didn't have much of a soul or much of a thought system. And I left with him. And I can remember driving down the interstate headed to the Crystal Palace off Stewart Avenue with this man in my car and kind of feeling creepy about it. And I thought, you know, he could cut me up in a million pieces and throw me in a dumpster and no one even would know what happened. And that was probably my first time that I thought, I don't care. Because I had lost my soul and I was just living to drink at that point. And we ended up going to Crystal Palace, and that place is open from like midnight to 10 a.m. or something. That's where all the bar people go. And I went home with him and went to bed and woke up about 2 in the afternoon to bang, bang, bang on the door. And he's jerking me out of the bed and shoving me under it. And he's crawling around on his hands and knees with a shotgun in his hand. And it's the police at the door. And I'm just thinking, what? That was my very small thought. What's going on? But my next thought was, I hope he has some alcohol. Oh my God, what am I going to do if he doesn't have any alcohol? Because I was physically addicted and I would start to go into tremors if I didn't have it. And they left, and I never asked him, what happened? What was that about? And I didn't really care. And I found out years later that he had multiple convictions of armed robbery and all kinds of crazy stuff. But anyway, I went to work one night. He dropped me off. He was in my car. This was about 3 months later. And he never came to pick me up at work. And I found out that he had gotten arrested for his 11th DUI in my car. And it took me forever to find my car. And he got out of jail, but he knew he was going to do some serious time. His name was Steve. And Steve knew that I was very sick, and so he called my parents, and he told them that I was going to die if I didn't get some help. And I was really, really angry at him. But my mother called me, who lived out in Wyoming at this time, and she said, you know, you're welcome to come here, but you need to go right into counseling. And I said, Mom, I think I probably need a little bit more than counseling at this point. I'm physically addicted to alcohol. I can't stop drinking. That, to me, was step one. I admitted that I was powerless over alcohol and my life was so unmanageable. So I went out to Wyoming, and I went into the Crestview Treatment Center. And the first day of treatment, they put me in a little isolation room and until they could get all my blood work and everything back. And I slept for about 2 hours, and I woke up, and I'm shaking, and I'm freaking out, and I'm locked in this little bitty room, and I went to the bathroom on myself, and I'm just a freaking mess, and I'm banging on the door, and the nurse comes in, and she says, I just want you to sit down. And I sat down, and she took my hand in hers, and she said, I just want you to close your eyes, and I want you to think about the ocean or something really soothing. And I did that for about 1 second, and then I said, are you effing crazy? Like, I need alcohol. I can't do this. And they had gotten my blood work back, and I had a 0.418 blood alcohol level, which is like deadly. And I had pancreatitis, cirrhosis, hepatitis, and they gave me, based on their findings, 4.5 months to live if I had continued on. And they put me on Librium, which was awesome. Because I thought, well, I can do sobriety. This is really great. And I was under the influence of Librium for 7 days. And when I went up to the little nurse's station on the 8th day to get my little cup of pills, she said, you don't get any more pills. You're done. And I said, no, you don't understand. I have really bad anxiety, and I have to have pills. And she said, Kim, you can see your doctor at 3 o'clock this afternoon, and we're done with you now, so go on. Well, that was the first time in a long time that I had not had a drink or drug in my body, from 8 o'clock that morning till 3 o'clock that afternoon, and it was scary. And I just had to do it. I had no choice. I met with the doctor at 3 o'clock in small group, and before he could even say a word, I said, I need my Librium. I don't know why you've taken me off of that. I have really bad anxiety, blah, blah, blah. And he said, group, I think Kim just needs a big hug. What do y'all think? And that wasn't really what I had in mind. So I actually said, F you and all your hugs, and I bolted out of there. And as I was leaving the room, he said, why don't you read We Agnostics in the big book? And I didn't really have anything better to do, because at this point, I'm not in there on my own. I'm state committed because of my condition. And so I have to serve my time. So I went up to my room, which was in Casper, Wyoming, a big snow-covered mountain outside, a big plate glass window, and I sat on my bed and I read that. And something came to mind. You know, you've been since 8 o'clock this morning without anything. Maybe you can do this. It's going to be okay. And I got some hope that day. And I think my soul maybe got a little tickle in it. So I started thinking about the God idea. And I didn't really know. You know, people were saying, well, you can pick a tree, or you can pick a doorknob, or you can pick any higher power of your choosing. And I just felt weird doing that. That was just my personal opinion. But so my mom suggested that I pick my dog, Gizmo. who was like my child at the time, had been with me through all of this and was staying with my grandmother while I was in treatment. And I thought, I'm not going to pick Gizmo. I think I'm just going to go with the God thing. And a week later, Gizmo was hit by a car and killed. But the greatest gift, because I thought, there is a God, because that God told me, don't you pick that dog to be your higher power. And so that was my step 2 and 3. I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I chose to call that power God. And when Gizmo died, and I was able to get through that day without a drink or a drug in my system, I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. I made a decision to move forward and to do the deal, because I had 2 days now that I had not had to have a drink or drug on the first day without Librium and the day that my dog died. And so I started to kind of believe in this thing, and my tickle in my soul got a little bit bigger. I did step 4 while I was in treatment. It was about 8 pages of craziness, like we all know. And I shared it with a priest, and he didn't fall over and die, and neither one of us caught on fire, and it was a huge lift off my shoulders to share those things with another human being. And he said, you're forgiven, and that was that. So it's my last day of treatment, and they said, I want you to write down your goals. And we got to have a little ceremony in front of the group. And my goal was to be able to walk into a 7-Eleven all by myself and buy a pack of cigarettes. And thank God, God had better plans for me than just to be able to do that, because that would have been really boring if that's all I got out of the deal. But that's how much I suffered from anxiety and from fear. And someone suggested that I read in the big book the story, and I don't even know if it's in the 4th edition, but it's The Man Who Mastered Fear. And I really related to that. Like, he had to take small walks around the block, and I was like, oh my God, there's someone out there like me. And I could relate to that. And so I started reading more of the stories, and I could relate to that. And, you know, that's really where I got connected. I started in the back of the book more than in the front. And because that's where I could relate to people's circumstances and situations. And that's why I listen to speaker tapes all the time, because it really keeps me connected and in the middle of the program. I just love them. The meetings in Saratoga were twice a week. This little town that I lived in with like less than 2,000 people and not a stoplight in it. And all the people in the meetings were men over 35 years old, most of them in their 50s and 60s. And I was a little 23-year-old stripper from Atlanta. But, you know, it's the language of the heart. And I got what I needed. And I didn't have a sponsor because there was no women that went. They all just kind of helped me out and taught me, you know, how to walk the walk of recovery. Steve got out of jail and came out to Saratoga. He was there 2 weeks, got drunk. I was the treasurer of our group. We kept all our money in a coffee can. He stole the coffee can. And he, you know, everyone in town knows everybody, but somehow he took a book of checks of mine and cashed them all at the liquor store, which that still blows my mind. Like, he's obviously not Kim, you know, but whatever. And I decided that I could not live that way because I was really, really serious about staying sober. While he was there for that 2 weeks, I got pregnant. And he ended up walking on foot out of town, actually, with a $20 bill and one of my AA medallions in his pocket, and came back to Georgia and made it here in 3 days. But I got pregnant. My mother really, really, really wanted me to have an abortion because I wasn't really self-sufficient. He was a mess. But because I had a soul now, and I had had multiple abortions when I was drinking because that was my form of birth control, I just wasn't going to do that. So I had that baby that's very close to my mother today. And, you know, all throughout this story is just God. God, if I would do what I needed to do, then God was going to take care of it. He's always done that for me. I ended up making a decision to move back to Atlanta when I was 2 years sober. And I came back here and I had that new baby, and I ended up getting back together with my high school sweetheart. I went to meetings a little bit, but not very regular. I didn't really like y'all. I didn't like the meetings here. And I basically made a decision to not go to meetings anymore. You know, I was a happy life, happy wife, new baby. Things were fine. I didn't have a desire to drink. I had a second baby, and shortly after that, I went batshit crazy. I had 5 years sober. I started having anxiety so bad that I couldn't leave my home. And then it got so bad that I wouldn't let my husband leave our home. The doctors were kind of, I kept calling them saying I wouldn't take any medication because I'd abuse medication. And they were saying, you need medication. We're afraid you're going to hurt your children. I'm not going to hurt my children. I just can't breathe. I can't sleep. I can't have a single thought run through my brain. And all I've thought about is, why am I here? Why am I here? I'm going to die. I know I'm going to die. Something's going to get me. I know I'm going to die. It was craziness. And I went to a psychiatrist. And I thought, well, if they prescribe medication, then maybe I'll take it. And when I went in there, he wanted to lock me up. 5 years sober. Nothing in my system. And so crazy that they want to lock me up for chronic depression, delusion, scary. Well, I'd been locked up, remember, in jail and in an institution. I was like, no, I'm not doing that again. And so I grabbed my purse. I said, thank you for your time. And I hauled ass out of there. And I got home, and I was sitting on my sofa rocking and coloring in a coloring book, trying to get my mind to stop. And Billy Graham was on TV talking about the Oklahoma City bombings and talking all about God. And I jumped up, and I said to my husband, I know what's wrong with me. And he said, what? And I said, I've lost God. I need to get to a meeting. And I went over to the Howe place, and it was about 5 minutes to the end of the meeting. I got in there, I sat down, they said, are there any burning desires? And I jumped up like a maniac, And I feel really, really bad to this day about any newcomers that might have been in that meeting. I said, I have 5 years sober, and I was told today that I need to be locked up, and I'm just a crazy mess, and I need help, and oh, is this what we get when we have some time? But there was an old-timer there, and anybody that's been on that side of town probably knew him. His name was Pat Wheeler. And he came up to me, and he was a grumpy old man. He was a wealth of knowledge, but he seemed grumpy. And he said, you need to go home, and you need to put in these tapes, and you need to listen to this. It'll save your life. And it was the new pair of glasses on cassette. And so I took it home, and I put it in our stereo system, and Chuck Chamberlain, he sounds like, too. And I'm blasting this because you can barely hear it, you know. The quality is so horrible. My husband's like, what the hell? But I started going back to meetings, and I got a lot out of a new pair of glasses, and I started to feel a part of again. And when I had 7.5 years sober, I was in a meeting over at my home group, and this woman came up to me, and she said, Kim, you have way too much time in recovery to be whining and bitching and complaining as much as you do. Have you ever really worked the steps? And after I got, you know, away from the FUs in my head, I was like, I got to thinking about it, and I was like, well, I did 1 through 5 in treatment, and I go to meetings, so, you know, it's kind of like that two-step. I'm powerless and still kind of sick, but I'm gonna try to give it away. And no, it doesn't work. 7.5 years, and no one ever asked me to sponsor them ever. Thank God. So she was facilitating a group called Navalco. So I said that I would do that. And I joined Navalco. And it's an intense step study that you do in a group. It's 14 weeks long. And I was so scared the first meeting that I went to. It was that same feeling that I had when I first got in recovery. Well, what if it changes me? Well, what if it's really weird? You know, I'm in a miserable state of sobriety, just white knuckling, and I'm so concerned that I might feel different. You know, it's all in my head. Well, we did the first 3 steps. We got to the 4th and 5th, and I wrote down my inventory. And this is an inventory of sober behavior. No alcohol to blame it on. I didn't do these things because I was drunk. I was stone cold sober and still suffering from the same stuff that I was when I got in here as far as emotion. So I did my 5th step. With another recovering person that I wanted what she had, and she was able to point out to me my part in everything. And I had been told that when you do this, you feel really good afterwards. Didn't work that way for me. The next day, I like wanted to shoot myself in the foot. I felt so horrible. And I called her up and I said, Darlene, I feel horrible. And she said, well, get out your book and let's read 6 and 7. And I was like, I never really even knew 6 and 7 were there. I mean, I'd seen them on paper and read them in meetings, but I never really focused on them. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. These were the things that were blocking me from contented sobriety. You know, these were things that I was missing. I made amends, started making amends, started my rounds of that, and I do have to say this, that my mother, when I came to her, she said, I was wondering when you were going to get around to that. Because she had done a little Al-Anon, you know, so she was familiar. I actually got a sponsor, and I actually had women ask me to sponsor them. So I'm in the middle of recovery and reaping the benefits, as my husband calls it, a spiritual high. And life is wonderful. And I joined a home group. Shortly after I worked the steps and started feeling really good about things, we got a phone call. In 1 year, I buried 4 people of this disease. My father-in-law was an alcoholic just like me. We used to fight over the vodka. He'd buy it, I'd drink it, water it down, and he'd say, someone's watering down my damn vodka. But he was too proud to get this, and he died of this disease. When he was struggling, I had 2 friends of mine in recovery go over and 12-step him. One of them had 23 years at the time. It was funny because he called me when they left and he said, some men just came over here to talk to me about their drinking. Did you send them? And I said, yes, I did. And he said, well, I'll pray for them. They have a really bad problem. So I tried. But the guy that had 23 years that went over there and carried the message, 2 years later, he took his own life, 25 years sober. And I don't know what got into his brain, but, you know, he took his life. And there was another guy that was in and out, in and out, in and out, could never put more than a few months together, and they found him hanging in a closet that year. And the other person that I buried that year was Steve. And he'd done his multiple time in prison and had gotten out, and I guess he felt hopeless, and he stopped downtown and got an 8-ball, and it was bad, and he was found sitting in his truck with it running, dead. But that was and still is so hard on me because he saved my life. He told on me. And I got help because of him. And he's not here to tell his story. You know, it's cunning, baffling, and powerful. And I don't know why some of us make it and some of us don't. But I do know that I've also buried a lot of people that were sober when they left this earth. Several old timers from my home group, I got to participate in some really cool things with them, going to their homes when they were on their last breath, and really, really cool things. My friend Darlene that told me I whined and bitched and complained so much, she died of cancer sober. And because I have a soul, I actually took care of her the last 2 months of her life and was able to give to somebody else. And I'm coming to the end here. You know, it's a very wonderful, wonderful way of life. but it's not always easy, and there's a little, you know, there's painful things. If you're upright, you're going to encounter some pain. There's just no avoiding it. And in 2009, my daughter went off to college, and my husband and I were at our office one day, and one of her sorority sisters came to our office and said, "I need to talk to you. Dallas is on drugs." And I said, "What kind of drugs?" I mean, I knew she drank and stuff, and she said, "Heroin." Wow. That was a tough one. And you know what I did? I called Terry that morning. And and I got some clarity, and I approached her, and we fought that battle until 2 years ago. We went through her overdosing in our bathroom and dying, having to be resuscitated. And I remember calling my sponsor and saying, "I can't breathe. I need help." And she'd meet me at McDonald's and talk me through the other side of it, because the most painful thing I think that we can encounter is losing some. It's dying. It's the end, you know. And that was really, really tough. But I'm happy to say that she will have a year sober next month. It was nothing that I did, because we sent her off eventually to Birmingham, got her out of here, and I just sent her with love and light, and God put wonderful people in her world, and she's doing really well, and I'm going to have my first grandbaby next month, too. And I think the greatest gift that came out of that situation with her is that I have learned so much love and tolerance in meetings. I've been known at times to be the bleeding deacon, but today I'd like to think that I'm somewhat of an elder statesman, because I don't want my child going into a meeting and some old-timer asshole calling her out and chasing her out of there. You know, "We don't do it that way in here. That's not what it says." Blah, you know. So, you know, really love and tolerance, because I view every person in the meeting, older than me, younger than me, it doesn't matter. That could be my child. And that person could die of this disease. And they're certainly not going to get anything out of I have to say if I'm just being a bitch and holier than thou. And so that's a great gift that I've been given through that. And last year, I've been pre-diagnosed since 2006 with MS, but last year they gave me the formal diagnosis. It was actually the same month that Dallas relapsed on heroin, but she's been sober now. And the day that I was diagnosed with that, I was supposed to tell my story that night. And I didn't really want to do that, because I wasn't really in a frame of mind. Even though I knew kind of that it was going on, it was still scary, and I was all into self and blah, blah, blah. But I went and I told my story. And when I left there, I was on my spiritual high. And I thought, you know, this is my life. This is my world. These are my friends. This is my family. And nowhere can I get as much love and support as in the rooms of recovery. And it doesn't really matter what's going on out there. There's, you know, it's such a language of the heart in here. And we all know what pain is. And we can get through pain sober, but together. You know, first word of the first step, the we. I really need you people. And I don't take that for granted anymore. And when I was newly sober and sitting around listening to speaker tapes, I came, a woman did a poem. It was actually an Al-Anon tape, but I wrote down the words and I carry it with me everywhere I go. I just love it. And it's kind of my life of recovery in a nutshell, and I'd like to share it with you. My life is but a weaving between my God and me. I do not choose the colors, but he worketh steadily, oft times in sorrow, sometimes foolish pride. I forget he sees the top while I the underside. Not till the loon is silent nor the shuttle cease to fly will God unroll the canvas to explain the reasons why. For the dark threads are as needful in a skillful weaver's hand as the threads of gold and silver in the pattern God has planned. I love you all.
Thank you, Kim. Thank you so much. You walked us through the steps. That was just incredible. Thank you. Now we're on a spiritual high. Thank you.